If it's an embarrassing question, personal, just say, I'm asking for a friend and we'll all believe you. Yes, sir.
So why did you actually originally choose to go into the subject of transgenderism and feminism? And
that's a very, very good question.
Repeat the question.
Dick?
Would you repeat the question?
Yeah. I'm going to rely on Dick to repeat the question because he has a more booming voice, and that'll allow me the opportunity to eat.
I think his question was, why did you decide to go talk about feminism and transgenderism? Because we told him to. Why else would... go ahead.
But I think your question is, why did I go into that work? Why have I been...
Oh, yeah.
The big thing is, like, how things started yesterday is the male and female thing, again, is not just like gambling, you know, an issue of like gambling or pornography or things like that. It is fundamental to, I'll answer this question kind of in a long way. A girl came up to me early and she said, I consider myself a Christian feminist. We think about that in a negative way, but like, no, what I talked about this after, or the, you know, this morning, I consider myself a Christian humanist in the sense of not that man is the measure of all things, but that God created all of us as humans. God himself became a human. What it means to be human is profound. Let's be students of what it means to be human. And the fundamental part of being human is either male or female. And that male and female represent the image of God. So in this culture today, and I started really studying it about 15 years ago with the same-sex marriage issue, those things, and I was just like, you know what, we need to go to school on this and really understand what it means to be male, what it means to be female, those kinds of things. And so the trans thing just comes along as a subset of that. Yeah. There was somebody back here who raised their hand. Yeah.
So you kind of told us where we've gotten to and the problems with that. How do we turn it around and correct what we need to?
I've got a three-step plan for how to fix everything. You know, I mean, that's the big, big question, right? I mean, that's what you're asking. The big thing that we need to know is we have never, ever been here as a church and as a culture considering the radical questions, because they're challenges to simply what it means to be human. And so we can't really look to any other age to, like, how did they do it? We've never been here before. And, I mean, we don't have answers. I think the big thing, first of all, is for all of us to go to school on these issues, and that's why this forum was very, very important. And then the other is just to have conversations with our neighbors, our family members, things like that. And you don't have to know how to answer every question, but you do have to know, like, how to bring up good points, you know, like the... You know, the thing of, well, you guys see women should, you know, like, what about the jet pilot? What about, you know, things like that that get other people to see another side of things. But here's what I think the big, big thing is, and this is important to us. Lies, and this is a lie about what it means to be human, lies can never sustain themselves. And Satan always overplays his hand. Think about this. At the cross, he got God to be put to death, humiliated, slandered, and he got the Father to turn his back on the Son. Okay? That's a huge victory. I mean, for him, it was like, nailed it. But then Resurrection Sunday morning came, you know? And he is like, I'm nailing it. I'm getting these people to, evil cannot sustain itself. It always overplays its hand. And so, like, the TERFs thing that I was talking about, for the demands from that community of, you cannot preach from the Word of God in your church. People are going to be like, okay, I thought this was about Frank and Jim next door being able to marry and mind their own business. You know, I never signed up for all of this stuff. And I think with the gender issue, people are seeing that. You know, the bathroom stuff, the little boy being able to wear a frilly dress to school. It's like, okay, I'm liberal, I'm open-minded, but like, yeah, this is pretty crazy. And again, that thing of like the TERFs with the, you know, this collision of these two ideologies that are not rooted in real truth. They smack into each other. But I think, here's another thing. This is an illustration I give. Truth is like a beach ball. Have you ever heard anybody say that before? And the culture is trying to push it down under the water. Don't pay any attention to it. It's inevitable force. The more you keep it down, the stronger you have to apply the pressure to keep it there. These things are not happening naturally. You know, they happen with great force and great political pressure. And that ball is ultimately going to come up. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That ball is ultimately going to come up. And we just have to hope it comes up sooner.
You eat while I add.
Okay.
I remember, Glenn, a couple of years ago, John Stone Street was here, and he was talking about some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about a couple of pastor friends of his that basically said, with the homosexual thing, all this stuff, that ship has sailed. And he gave in. Not that he promoted, but he just gave in. And I think that part of the answer that you're saying is, let's get informed. Let's be that beach ball that doesn't get pushed down. We can speak well, but we have to be informed and not give up. And I think that one of the most grievous articles I've ever seen is an article that was written several years ago, and it's something on the order of the silent shepherds. Let's don't be silent people.
The other thing there, and this is very important that we need to know, and Dr. Dobson, I mean, I worked for him for years, and this is a inside the family kind of disagreement, you know, me disagreeing with Dad, respectfully. He, in the early 90s and late 80s, would say, and this was one of his talking points, the Civil War for the cultural values that we hold to will be won or lost in the next 5 years, okay? And, like, applause. And in many ways, that is true. But I had a friend who asked me, at Focus, he says, and then what? The thing is, the mistake that makes is that any time in history, there is just a door that shuts. And, like, no discussion at all after this. It ignores cultural dynamic. You know, never... is history goes on, and there are debates, there are discussions, never at a point where, and unless you're put in a gulag, you know, no, we don't want to hear from you anymore. There's always this challenge and balance and exchange of ideas. Now, we could be losing, and we are losing in many ways, but we still have a voice. That dynamic, the cultural dynamic is still... is still going on. And so to say it's 2020 and we have won, the left has won. You know what? You've won for now and you've won in certain issues, but culture just doesn't work that way. It always has life to it. It always has a dynamic. It's what the philosophers call a dialectic. It goes this way, it goes this way. Sometimes it goes way this way and it comes back to here. But you know, you look through history and there are good times and there are bad times. Sometimes the bad times are dominating, sometimes the good times are dominating. So we need to understand this, is that the game is always in play. As long as we have a voice, as long as we have convictions, and as long as people on the other side of our issues have a voice and convictions, this will keep going. So no, it's never going to get to a place where, go back to the dugout, you're out of the game. There's always hope, there's always life, until us as Christians, until the trumpet blows, you know?
Richard?
I have a question that deals with the Prohibition era. You said that the temperance movement was sort of the women's rebellion against the way alcohol was used towards the men. And my question is what kind of flipped it from going the women supporting, or you know, people that are against alcohol consumption, to where it's now they were against the women that were supportive of that movement, to a more feminist role?
You know what? And there's a lot of different answers to that. Marxism in the universities, I mean, the radicalness came out of universities. And very unique, elite kind of women who, like, didn't live in reality and didn't have to live in reality, you know? And where in the universities, and in many ways it's still this way, but, like, Marxism was the background music, if you will, that like informed everything. And so out of that, you had this power dynamic and the inequities of power dynamics. And then you had, you know, the small handful of feminist writers that were writing, the Feminine Mystique, Gloria Steinem, those kinds of people. But here's another thing that we do not really appreciate, because we think about these things in terms of morality and thinking and right thinking and wrong thinking. But these things came about in times of great economic prosperity, where we could afford to think big thoughts, where we could afford to, like, okay, you know what? I mean, it was kind of like the tech bubble, you know, in the 90s or coming into, you know, like, everything will just always be great. The sexual revolution that I was telling you about in the 20s, that was right before the Great Depression. Things were wonderful. Things were great. You know, we could do anything. We could think anything. Then when the crunch comes, think about this. 9/11 came, and manhood and stepping up and protecting and caring for women was like everything. The atheists who, like, you know what, no, we can do without God, they weren't getting much of a voice. When push comes to shove, it reduces things down to what we really believe, what is really true. It's the same thing with the trans thing today, you know? We live in a very, you don't have trans things and stuff in a subsistence culture where, like, we've got to collect the food for tomorrow, you know, in that way. So even just the way that economics affects things is very, very important. And so I think those are two big, big things. And this is the other thing. It's interesting that, and you know, conservatives have said this, is it's interesting on the college campuses, capitalism is so attacked as evil. These people are built on a capitalist system where there's extra money to pay for luxuries like extended education. And people like you sitting around thinking big thoughts, you know? It's capitalism and the excess economic productivity of capitalism that provides for that kind of thing. For you guys to think big thoughts that are really quite contrary to the way that most people live. So.
Tom?
So, you mentioned, obviously, there's a fragmentation of family, and as a result, poverty in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I see those that's a spiritual problem, and that's a political problem.
Mm-hmm.
So where did those two, political problems and the spiritual church problem, intersect and come together to solve the problem?
It's interesting that I would, you know, again, and the guy from Focus would disagree with you a little bit in the church problem. And only this is that, yes, the church is one of the best custodians, if you will, of family and family values. But remember, and this, I'm not saying this is what you're saying, but remember, the intact, cohesive, monogamous family is needed in all civilizations and cultures. So every culture, regardless of their religion, they need to and come up and step up and enforce, enhance, be the custodians of that ideal. And it does exist in lots of places where the church either has not or doesn't, you know, play some sort of role. But for our culture today, our situation, yes, that is largely, in many ways, the church's responsibility, because the government is not doing that. The kind of everyday values that we're seeing are not doing that. But the intersection of the church and politics is very interesting. I mean, I'll be facetious with you. It's like there's no intersection there at all, because we live in the separation of church and state, and you should not be bringing your morals to the state house, you know, to influence. That's what law is somebody's values. You know, basically what they're saying is we don't want your kind of values. The other thing is, and this is a part of the talk that I give on the practical, deep consequences of strong families. If we're a governor, if we're a mayor, if we're a president, we want our citizens to do well. We want child health to be very good. We want child education to do well. We want domestic violence to be way down. We want employment to do well. I mean, just on and on and on and on. If we as a mayor, if we as a governor know the social science, we will say one of the most important factors and criteria that we need in our state is as many children as possible to be raised by their married mother and father. And if we can have a high population of that, our state's going to do good. If that breaks apart, apart from morals, you know, things are not going to go well. It's interesting. There's a talk that I give, and I kind of give the history of the contemporary debate on family form. And it really started with what I talked about either this morning or last night with the Moynihan Report from the Johnson administration. That was really the first effort to have a public conversation about what forms of families we need. That was a Democrat. And the talk that I give is, I give this history right up to the present. The highest peaks in that discussion of what families should we have more of and which should we not, every high peak was a scholarly breakthrough from a more left-leaning scholar. And these were scholars like George Akerlof in that economic thing who were just doing good work, you know? And it's like this peak, this peak, this peak, you know, and I go the talk all the way across the board. These were the big developments. And they're all Democrats. They're all Democrats who have said these are the strongest points that inform what Focus believes and what we go out and make the case for. It is stunning. It's just absolutely stunning. Again, these are honest people that are just taking an honest look at what happens when fathers leave the home. It was the Clinton administration that started the first fatherhood initiative, and it was good. It was, we want real fathers in real homes being men, and then the Bush administration continued that. So there are some of these good things happening. And the research that I talked about yesterday that my buddy Brad Wilcox and Wendy Wang, W-A-N-G, you can look at those, and family formation in California. They said that the divorce rate in California is really relatively quite low. And it's because of not so much the left, but the elites. The elites they don't talk about family values, but they live them because they know that's the way to live. You know, they know that life works out better that way. And then you have, of course, you know, very, very big Hispanic population. But you talk to the really, really good Democrats kind of scholars, they'll tell you, of course, you know what, kids do better with married mom and dad. And so that's that intersection, and that's a lot of my work, what I call reading out of the book of Scripture, here's what God says, and let's look at the best research. And surprisingly, not surprisingly, it tells the story of what Scripture says. Why? My boss at Focus, early on, good man, he said, Glenn, what if you do this research and you find that it doesn't support what Scripture says? Good question. My response was, facetiously, tongue-in-cheek, then God doesn't know what he's talking about. Because God just didn't give this willy-nilly list of rules. He's saying, I have come that you might have life and life abundantly. You know, do these things and you will prosper. Don't do those things and bad things will happen. Well, when scholars come along and just observe men committed to their families, what happens when that happens? Good things happen. What happens when monogamy is the norm? That research that we looked at, you know? Good things happen. So these good scholars who, like, they just want to be good scholars and do good objective work. And there's a number of them that do. And they're really the ones that the other scholars really look up to and respect. So that's a fascinating thing, that in that world, amazing work is being done. And being able to do this work in the last 25 years and see the coherence between these two things is really fascinating. So here's divine revelation, here's natural revelation that the scholars are doing, and you see that there's that connection there. So,
Dallas?
Glenn, I called my pastor friend after this morning's session and encouraged him to use your materials with his youth group of men, boys, and he has a 15 to 20 minute session at the end of their meetings where they usually watch a video clip. Is the type of information that you talked about last night concerning manhood and masculinity, can it be taken from Focus on the Family and produced in a video form for these youngsters that are going to be men soon?
Somebody had asked me that earlier, and my answer to that is I'm not sure if I have it online. Kind of what, I mean, I don't really have a strategy. I need to, like, okay, get this talk online, so that it fills out the library, if you will. I would think that the talk I gave last night is somewhere online, that, you know, like, talk I gave today, if Dick's people happen to have taped it and put it online, that's how my stuff gets out there. So
we
I'm not.
Didn't.
Yeah.
He did. It's there already.
Okay. It's okay.
This is Brian Power.
There you go. I just found that out. But it's the audio, right?
It's the audio. Okay. Yeah.
I knew it was on the website, word for word, from what we heard ourselves. But the pastor was asking me, is there a 15 to 20 minute overview of what you did in 2 hours last night that would be succinct for a weekly meeting for young men?
Not yet, unfortunately. But I need to work on that and create that kind of stuff. Yeah, it is.
There was a back in the box. Go ahead.
I was wondering.
Louder.
I was wondering how Focus on the Family is dealing with effective communication to those outside who have a tendency to reach their own choir.
Yes. There's two sides of that. How is focus, you know, kind of in this new, there's a technical side of that, you know, like how many people listen to radio as opposed to podcasts and videos and things like that. We have started a number of podcasts on like a parenting podcast, marriage podcast, you know, for like subgroups. And those are really doing quite well. And those are reaching more of the unchurched population than radio has. It is surprising, though, the letters that we get every week that say, I'm not a Christian, I don't know anybody who is a Christian, but I was driving along and I was just flipping through the dial and I heard your broadcast on X, and that show existed that day for me because it like just read my mail. And just, I mean, just absolutely remarkable in that way. Jim is much more, simply just because of generation, Jim is much more attuned to how to speak cross-culturally in terms of speaking to people who are different than we are. And he does that very, very well. And, you know, the things that we're creating online, print materials, you know, the Truth Project, other video things, we're thinking about that because we want to speak to larger audiences and not watering down our message, not changing our message, but just the way you deliver it. Again, in form and format, but also in the language itself. But that's an ongoing thing that we're trying to do better and better and better.
Other questions?
And any questions that you might have about focus? And any questions? Why are you guys so stupid to do it this way? You can ask that.
Dennis, I interrupted the two of you when you were talking. Did you have a question that you wanted to come back to?
No, not that I really important right now. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess I lean on the woman.
She's got good.
Provides focus to my life.
Right.
Very helpful. So, Mr. McGill touched on earlier, you know, in the political realm, I serve as a legislator here in Billings, representative, and so this concept of man and woman is constantly played out every day. You know, the Standing Committee on Human Services. We see the chaos that's created by the government's sometimes good and oftentimes major missteps on how what they think the family should look like, mm-hmm. or what is politically expedient. I'm still not formulating a question. I guess would you speak to that?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody from the political side who's enacting legislation or trying to do the best they can.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, just as you say this, and I kind of referred to this last night, and it goes to the California thing, is, you know, to stand up on the floor and to ask, you know, we're dealing with this piece of legislation. In Tennessee, the governor just signed this anti-gay discriminatory bill. But basically what it was, and that's the way it's presented, was in our state, in adoption, we will give favor to married mom and dad families. And we will not see. It's not that the other can adopt, but we will favor this kind of family to give kids moms and dads first. If you were to stand up on the floor, you know, and say, if you were to move into a neighborhood, a new neighborhood, and it was chock full of kids that are raised by married mothers and fathers, would that be a preferable neighborhood? Or a neighborhood where there's a rainbow of different relationships between the children and their parents? It's wonderful. You'd see that, you know.
Don't use that word rainbow.
You know, you think in a real practical sense, no, I want to live in that neighborhood. Because we know intuitively, apart from idealism, we don't use idealism in like where we'd like to fashion our lives and found our lives. It's, no, in this community, every man and every woman is married and every child has a married mother and father that are, they're not all happy, but you know what? They're doing pretty well. That's a, and I want my kids to go to that school alongside other kids like that, as opposed to this community over here where everybody's cohabiting. Everybody knows those are going to be two qualitatively different kind of communities. And so to use that as the way to demonstrate, none of us live according to our, you know, ideals of what ought to be. They're good for other people, but not for us necessarily. And I think that's important to be able to show people and demonstrate kind of, you can't even really live by your own convictions, unless you're just like hardcore, you know, angry sort of person. Most mainstream people, left or right, they understand these things.
I think what a lot of people don't realize is the foundation that you're talking about allows people to then disagree. No, this isn't the way to do it, but still their feet are firmly planted on the society that was founded by mom and dad and establishing a strong family. You know, it's ironic.
And a Judeo-Christian base.
Oh, very much so.
Right? We just assume like, oh, all cultures are like we are. I mean, feminists, go to a Muslim country and take your bets there, you know. You will come crawling back to a Christian nation, you know.
Curtis, you had a question.
You said that in times of prosperity, we see these issues like feminism, homosexuality, whatever. You're mentioning a $1 trillion deficit. Where will our society end up in that ability to borrow everything and this thing changes around, goes the other direction, which college will?
That's very interesting, and that is, I mean, a couple of things run through my mind is, sometimes you'll hear pastors say, what the church needs is just a good persecution, is what the church needs is some hard times. That clarifies, that hardens things, that focuses things. 9/11, you know, any UCLA person who, you know, September 12th, 2001 said, but let us remember that we can't talk about God. No, everybody was talking about God. And not in just this sentimental way. When push comes to shove, when it's like, okay, the economy's tanking, things are really bad, it's, you know, there are no atheists in the foxhole, right? It's just human nature that focuses human energy in an uncanny kind of way.
And I think some of that stuff that we inherently know in our gut is wrong, that doesn't make sense, it tends to kind of pass by the wayside too, at least to me, because I believe in Romans 2, 1 and 2, that every man knows, every woman knows, deep down inside, what right and wrong is. It takes different forms. And
think about this. We could have a conversation about firemen and police and rescue personnel, that there should be equity in trans people working in that field, okay? In the hypothetical. But if you came out 5 days after 9/11, why are we not seeing in those rescue pictures an equity of male and female rescuers and even trans rescuers and representative of gay and lesbian? If you did that to the American people, you would have sounded so stinking stupid, right? Because when it comes down to it again, like, yeah, no, this is not about that. And you just sound whiny, which they are. But in the ethereal, when everything's fine and we can consider, well, no, we put up with that. We can tolerate that. So, and the debt thing, I mean, like any family budget, you're going to have to pay the piper. And that is a serious, serious thing. But the upside is it could clear the deck for all this goofiness.
Roger.
Yeah, Glenn, this actually started as a side conversation, which Pence
squashed.
But obviously, you know, there's no blueprint for the perfect man other than Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to understand him better. But some years ago, a friend, mutual friend, told me about a book that his wife gave him. Given it to him even before they got married. I never bought the book, but I've always liked the title, and I wanted to ask you what you think of this concept. The title of the book was The Man of Steel and Velvet.
Ooh.
And yeah, I wondered, you know, I start thinking, over the years, I kind of like to think of myself that way personally. I know that's presumptuous, but or at least to aim for that kind of a man. But I guess part of my question is, it's easier for men to be and show the steel than maybe the velvet. But are there things that maybe you're traditionally in our culture thought of as very, very much. That actually are things that can make a man a stronger man?
Well, Roger's question dates him because that book is really old and good.
Thanks, Dick. I need it.
I think it's one of the first books that Gutenberg actually printed. Right. But no, that is exactly the balance of masculinity. If you're familiar with the book Wild at Heart, the author of that, John Eldridge, he's a friend of mine. He hired me at Focus. And so again, this is the in-family discussion. There's a lot of great stuff in that book, but what I didn't really care for was he focused on the toughness, the adventure part, and even like, you know, the man goes out and he seeks his dream. And I would always ask the question of, so what about the poor Chinese rice farmer? You know, honey, I've got to go out and I'm going to take up this thing called repelling, you know, or it's just like that happens within a, you know, largely kind of white suburban sort of scene. But it also doesn't allow for that soft side. God is mighty, Jesus is mighty, but he's also very soft and tender too. And if you see, I mean, think about, again, for any of us, we're very, you know, there's objective male or female, but think about a very strong man whose children come in to sit in his lap and just, you know what, Daddy, can I snuggle with you? And that man goes, no. Little boys don't do that, you know? Like, you know what? You're not a nice person. For the big lumberjack kind of guy, or the guy who can, like, you know what? There's nobody who can whip me, and I can get myself out of any situation. For that man to go, you know what, honey? come up and sit in my lap, and even calls his son honey, you know, and kisses on him. One of my friends that I grew up with, he's like a big, big guy like that, and he still does it to this day. Both of his sons played football on scholarship. He kisses them on the cheek every time that he sees them and leaves them. And he's like, he's a guy's guy. So nobody looks at that and just says, dude, you know, are you trying to womanize your boys? Most of us are like, that's awesome, you know? So there is that tenderness, and that tenderness toward women. And so, I mean, that author knew exactly what he was saying. He said, you know, he wasn't trying to introduce something new. He said, how do we balance these things out? And we see that in Jesus. But we also, if we think about the good men that we know and men's men, they will have that side to them. And hopefully we can think about either, you know what, my dad and my granddad had that and it was wonderful, or my dad and my granddad didn't have that and we say that with sadness, you know? So there's, you know, one of the things that I say about the universal quality is men always will value the underdog and never exploits the underdog, you know? If he's fighting somebody and the guy trips or something, you know, like, I want you to stand on your feet so that we can really compete with one another. I'm not going to exploit your weakness, you know, generally in that way.
Can I interrupt a second? Let's hear it for the waitress.
She's like, reflect that applause in your tip. Thank you. But it's that. And I think it's that's important for older men to show younger men is what are those things? That, son, there's something very strong and masculine in showing a tenderness.
One more question, and then we've got to go. Dale?
Last week. Thinking about there isn't a natural process for the boy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a transition, and so there's, you know, he talks like a girl, he sounds like a girl,
yep.
You know, and all that, but I thought it, you know, what you had said is that how important it is for the male to be reinforced and brought up by another man.
Yeah. That is, I mean, there's a lot there, and that's a very, very interesting question that, and it's not this way with all boys, and you know that, is, you know, the little boy will, you know, contend to talk like a girl, play like a girl. And there are some boys like, okay, that kid came out of the womb, you know, a crusher. But like my son, he had four sisters. And I remember when he was little and they're all playing in the playroom and he loved these little, we had a pair of Dorothy slippers, you know, sparkly. And he loved to wear those. And he would dress up in a little skirt like his sisters did. Okay, so you think, okay, Glenn, commence freaking out right now, you know? And like, I knew enough to, no, he's just simply doing what the others around him are doing. His, like, I'm a boy stuff hasn't really kicked in yet. And so I gotta keep an eye on that. You know, if it goes on a little bit longer, there's the time where I have to go, you know what, buddy? And not kind of shame him, but you know what? When I was your age, I had this cowboy outfit, you know? So I'm not saying that's what you ought to do, but I'm saying this is what I did. If you want to identify with me, you know, he's like, wow, that's what you did? You know, I want one of those. So it's not like, you know, it's just an identity that you're giving him, and an identity that men need to give. While he was young, you know what, he's just identifying with his sisters. He's just playing with them. That's fine. But as, you know, the cement starts to harden a little bit, you know, in that way, that's very, very important. But here's the big, big thing, that men and women participate in the forming of the man. And it's interesting, I was talking to somebody the other night. She's a single mom, and her son is 15 years old. And she was, and she's a great mom, but she's saying, you know what, sometimes I'm like, her son's name is Riley. Riley, is everything okay? I mean, you're kind of just shutting down. You know, we talked wonderfully last night, and she like, sometimes he just turns off. And I was like, Shannon, you know what that is? He's breaking away from you. She's like, that's what I'm afraid of. And I'm like, no, that's a good thing. You know, it's, you've got to let him become the man that he's becoming. We recognize that in our husbands, you know. And she was like, and she's a brilliant woman, you know, but she's like, wow, really? I'm like, yep, really. That's what that is. When he wants to talk, you know what? Joke, laugh, but recognize this is not personal, you know, and let him be that. And so that is an example of mom needs to push the boy away a little bit, okay? It's called, and I'm surprised, I find this, I don't think you guys would, but the phrase cutting the apron strings, there's so many people like, yep, I've never heard of that. But cutting the apron strings is a thing because it's a thing, you know? Like, you know what, son? Don't identify with me so much. The mom pushes away. The mom creates the break. The dad needs to invite in. The dad has his arms open and says, come here. And it's not just the dad, but it's the whole fraternity of men who are saying, you're becoming one of us, and we're going to accept you into to our fraternity, if you will. And so that's what I was doing, like with Schaefer. Schaefer, you know what I loved to do when I was little? You know, I'm inviting you to be like me. It's interesting that I'll do this, and I think this is very important to do, that you can't know little kids' stories, but you can just know by sheer data that I do it with little boys when they're with their dads, but a lot when they're with their moms, is you see them at the store, and you go, hey, little man, and you fist bump them, okay? First of all, the mother and the father will go, you know what? What you're saying is, I identify with you. And the fist bump, you know, is like, you're one of us. That's a very important thing that the society is doing to say, you know, that's a, if you will, a contemporary ceremony that primitive tribes would have of like, now you're a man. You're putting into that boy, I identify with you with as one of me. And I think that's little things like that that are very important. The other is, like I said the other night, in a room, you know, like here, somebody comes in, there's not enough chairs. And the man can get up and get the chair, but you see this dad's doing this, it's like, hey boys, why don't you go get some chairs? And they go get the chairs, they bring them in, thank you. You know, the boy is like, that's pretty cool. You know, I solved the problem. I was thanked, things like that. That's a big thing. I'll end with this, is, you know, we hear like in primitive tribes, the boy going out for the hunt and bringing back the kill. The boyness, the manness of that is not so much the kill. It's not like, okay, I went out and, ugh, I got blood on my hands. And it's that second P, it's the provision. The manness is the bravery to go out. Do I have the skills to do it? That's that. But the real manness comes back when he comes into the tribe with the kill around his shoulders. Not even just that, but when it's cooked and when the women say, "This is a nice one." And then when he's sitting around and he sees everybody eating off of what he got, he kind of puffs up. Because it's not the, it's the "I provided." These people, my tribe is enjoying this because of something that I did. I am now a man. And that's a pretty cool feeling, and I can't wait to get back out there and to do it again. So it's that, and that's that softness, if you will, you know? And, I mean, we all know that. When you think about that boy sitting there, he's a different creature than when he woke up that morning.
What do you think of this guy?
Thank you.
What lunch is about is I contract for these speakers for 4 talks.